I also thank Hashem for being involved in Kirov. Otherwise, I'd have to actually get a real job. This evening I was asked to speak about three topics. The topic of evil and suffering, the topic of women's status in Judaism, and the topic of the rabbinic authority and the oral law. And I was asked to do that in 40 minutes and leave 20 minutes for questions and answers. So forget that. There's no way that's going to happen. We will try to address some of the issues as much as we can. I don't know if we'll have 20 minutes for questions and answers. I mean, there's a fair amount to pack in. I wanted to begin with two very important foundational ideas regarding answering questions. Number one is that not every question has an answer. There is no guarantee that every question will be answered. And we have to understand that any philosophy, every aspect of science, every area of human knowledge, there are questions in these areas. There is no area of knowledge that the human being has. There's no theory. There is no there's no system which absolutely every single question is answered. It just doesn't exist. So no one has given up physics. Physics has been trying for literally thousands of years, since Aristotle more or less, to answer the deep questions about the nature of the universe. Today, physics is very, very advanced, but the fact of the matter is there are still, according to an article I saw recently in Scientific American, six great unanswered questions in physics. Okay, no one has given up the effort. No one has dropped physics. No one has started to ignore gravity. No one has decided that E does not equal MC squared, right? No one has decided that. They're still basically in physics. It's the same is true in biology. The same is true in medicine. Many, many areas of life don't have answers to every single question. The fact is, the Torah does have an answer to every question, but I may not understand it. The other person may not understand it. We don't necessarily have the answers. No guarantee ever on the birth certificate that says all questions guaranteed to be answered by age 48, right? There's no such thing. So that's number one. And therefore, it is possible sometimes to say, I don't know. Sometimes to say, it's a great question. I often have told the fact that Rav Simcha Wasserman, son of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, Rav Simcha used to do a question-answer session in Yerushalayim for beginners. Total beginners, people who were brought from the Kotel, in the Hebrew, Mishustar, brought by Rabbi Shuster, in other words. And they would ask him all types of questions. And so I remember there was a new guy came in, and he asked a question of Rav Simcha Wasserman, and he says, could you please explain the sacrifices? Please explain the sacrifices. And I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be interesting. And Rav Simcha looked at me and says, I don't think so. They bother me a little bit too. Next question. And I'm thinking to myself, oh no, damage control, you know, whoop, 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 right, et cetera, you know. So as soon as the class finishes, I walk over to this guy, say, what do you think of the class? Like, full of fear. And he said, oh wow, the honesty of that man. A great sage like that, to be able to say he doesn't know, very, very, it's amazing. I was very impressed by that. I'd like to continue learning further. I thought, wow, amazing thing. But you should realize that shouldn't be your policy. In other words, someone asks you a question. I don't know, good question, excellent, bothers me too, have no idea. Right? Obviously, Rav Simcha Wasserman answered 95% of the time. It's just that every now and again he said, I don't know, the world is not going to fall. As the Yiddish expression goes, you don't die from a kasha. Important point to know, and this tonight is a little bit of a contradiction to that, but the second important point is that not all questions can be answered in 5 minutes. Just not going to happen. If someone asks me at the end of a lecture, could you please explain suffering, please explain what, and it's a lecture on a different subject, my response usually is, no, I can't do that in 5 minutes. Are you prepared to spend an hour with me? 2 hours? Maybe I can, right? Maybe a week? The Rambam notes this is not a new problem. The Rambam in Moreh HaNevuchim, Guide for the Perplexed, points out, he says, if you'd tell someone, would you like to know the secret, the answer to life, the universe, and everything, right? And I will tell it to you, and you ask a person, and they'll say, yes, sure, I'd love to hear it. And you say, okay, it's going to take a couple of months. Most people's reaction will be, forget it. How about a few weeks? Forget it. How about a week? No way. How about an hour? Most people won't even give you an hour. So we have to understand that not every question can be answered in 5 minutes. You could tell a person that, look, it's not just not reasonable to expect that a question which has been bothering some of the greatest minds in history will be answered in a few minutes. I remember, of course, some people do expect that. I remember I was in a reserve duty. I was in a tent in the Israeli army. I was in the Golan Heights. We're in a tent resting in the afternoon. Everyone's lying around on their bunks, you know, and a guy leans over and he says, Becher, Tagidli. Right? He says, Becha, tell me. He says, Lama tzadik v'ralo, rasha v'tovlo. Why do the righteous suffer and the evil prosper? And I said, Achshav v'tarasavadan. Now you want to know? He says, Ken, Achshav. Yeah, now. So I say, look, I need to give you a few introductions. He says, don't give me introductions. Know what rabbis do. Right? Introduction after introduction after introduction. I'll forget the question, and that's it. So I said, you expect me to answer a question, which is, where there's an entire book of the Tanakh written in response to this question, the book of Eov. I said, Moshe Rabbeinu asked the question, didn't get an answer. I said, every major philosopher of every religion has discussed this question at length, and you expect in 5 minutes in a tent in the Golan Heights, in shorts and t-shirts, to get an answer to this question without any haktana whatsoever. And he said, Betach, yeah, sure. Totally. So that's what people expect, you can't do it. Okay, so let me start with the question of evil and suffering and the Holocaust. Obviously, the Holocaust is a very intense and prime example of evil and suffering. But the truth of the matter is, from a philosophical perspective, we have to understand that the suffering of the Holocaust is no different from, it is different in quantity, but qualitatively, every suffering, which apparently is undeserved, raises the same question. Okay, this is a question. In other words, the Holocaust suffering is a question. It's a question, but the fact that it's a Holocaust to us is so overwhelming, and we're so emotionally attached to it, and we are so close to it, because 7 years, not a long time in Jewish history, not a long time in world history, right? 7 years is a very small time, so we are so deeply embedded in it, we have such personal, an emotional investment in it, it's very difficult for us to separate ourselves from it on a philosophical level. But when you think about it on a philosophical level, it is not a greater question if 10 people suffer than if one person suffers in an unjustifiable way. It's not a greater question if 100 people suffer in an unjustified way. It's the same philosophical question. Okay, most of us, and the Gemara says, for example, that that one is rewarded for silence. Right, Igra debay Tamia Shtikusa, one is rewarded for silence in the house of mourning. When you go to a shiva, you go to a house to comfort a mourner, they do not want a speech, and they cannot handle a speech about the reason for suffering. That's not the appropriate response. The appropriate response is sympathy, empathy, silence, love. That's why you're rewarded just for being quiet. The same is true with the Holocaust for so many Jews. It is such an emotional issue. It is very difficult to give someone a speech about it and to have them stand back. Because standing back is not a human thing to do. We're still involved. But we have to try to do that anyway. So when we come to the question of suffering, we have to understand, first of all, I usually point out to people that if you are bothered by suffering, if you are bothered by the existence of evil, it really bothers you, then that very often is an indicator that you have an expectation that there should be justice. If you have an expectation that there should be justice, that probably is because you believe in God. In other words, the expectation that things should be in such a way that tzadik v'tovlo, rasha v'ralo, that a righteous should prosper and the evil should suffer, why do you expect that? You only expect that because you have a deep set belief that things should be otherwise. Why should they be otherwise? Because there is a God. So the question bothers us. It's not a bad thing that it bothers you, because if it bothers me, that means I believe, I have an expectation that there is a God. Secondly, we may not be able to answer general, we may not be able to answer individual cases, only a general idea, because individual cases require too much information about the person, which we're not necessarily privy to. Let's start with one response to the existence of evil. I'll give you a few responses, and then what I think is the main answer. The first response usually is, we see a righteous person suffering. We see tzadik v'ralo. So our answer usually is we can question one of two things. We can question whether this person is really righteous, or we can question whether that is happening is really bad. Is that clear? In other words, you've got a clash between good person, bad thing. So you could either attack the good person concept, or you could attack the bad thing concept. Make sense? Okay, so when we attack the good person or bad person concept, that is what we call reward and punishment. What Rav David Gottlieb calls a past justification for present suffering, or a past justification for present prosperity of the wicked person. And I'll give you some examples of that. First of all, not all who appear good are in fact good. As we know, the Gemara says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu medakdekim at tzadikim kechut asara, Hashem is as exacting with the righteous as a hairbreadth, because more is expected of a righteous person. More is expected, as opposed to government, where the higher you go in government, the more you can get away with, right? And if you're at the highest position, you could lie, you can perjure yourself in court, and what happens to you is this horrific thing called impeachment, which is basically meaningless. After impeachment, you can still get $5 million for a speech, right? You can still get book contracts. What does impeachment do? I don't know. Halavai, we could only be impeached for stuff, right? But the way it works morally is it works differently. The more, the higher up you are in the levels of morality, the more that is expected of you. And there's a great analogy for this I heard in the name of Eli Elopian when he was a little kid. He was in, I think in Poland is where he lived, and his mother used to take out the crockery to dust it from the cabinet every couple of months. So she takes out the crockery, it's on the table, all the fine china, and he's bouncing a ball. To his horror, the ball hits his foot and goes onto the table and breaks some china. His mother comes in, what are you doing? She gives him a punch or whatever, and she punishes him and with the standard punishments in Poland, which nowadays are considered child abuse. And basically, she... terrible punishment. Anyway, it's very upsetting to him. The next time his mother brings out the china, he goes into the dining room, he sees the china there, he takes the ball and he puts it away, right, and he's just watching, and to his horror, the window is open and a turkey, in Yonata Yoima, a turkey jumps on the window, right, it wasn't a turkey, it was a goose, actually, sorry, right, Poland didn't have turkeys, right, a goose jumps on the windowsill and stretches out its wing and smashes a piece of the china. So his mother comes in, she sees him, he's pointing to the goose, and says, oh, okay. She gently takes the goose and places it outside the window, closes the window. And little Eli Elopian is thinking to himself, I wish I was a goose. I break the china, I get a patch, right? The goose gets placed gently outside. That was until the next Yontif. Next Yontif, he sees the goose again, this time it's on the china. And he says to himself, sometimes it's worth being the goose. Sometimes it's worth getting the patch, so I'm not the goose in the end. In other words, there's an idea that obviously more is expected of little Eli Elopian than is expected of the goose, right? And indeed, he says that the idea behind it is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects more of us, and therefore there is indeed a greater level of din for a person who's on a higher level. A person could ask, is it worth it? The answer is yes. I saw a beautiful, it's a discussion about this in a journal of philosophy, but the discussion was the following question they asked. There's a child, a boy of 15, but because of a neurological disorder, he basically is on a maturity level of a 5-year-old. He spends all day playing Lego. Now, you are a brain surgeon, and you have the ability, a new operation, right? You have the ability to do this operation and give that child the normal maturity and intelligence of a 15-year-old boy. Would you do it? Would you do it? I think most of us would probably say, yes. But you know, if you did that, you would be exposing this child to a lot of pain, wouldn't you? Not from the operation. The operation is under anaesthetic. Not a problem there. But the pain he'd have is that this child, he goes to school. You know how kids are? They say, where have you been, Pastor Stu? Which school were you at? And what's he going to tell them? And there's going to be a lot of cruelty. And he's going to catch up on a tremendous amount socially, tremendous amount intellectually, tremendous amount culturally. It's going to be very, very difficult for him. So you've now exposed him to tremendous pain. Have you done the right thing? I think the answer is, yes, you have. Why? Because the range of experience, the depth of ability, the greatness of his abilities and the success that he can achieve and what he can achieve in life and the growth he can achieve as a regular 15-year-old versus what he was beforehand far outweighs the suffering. And so that is one idea. And we find, so that's higher standards for the righteous. In addition, we also believe that we are all responsible. We don't know if everyone here understands that, but we're responsible one for the other. Kol Yisrael Reivim Zebezer, not only for the Jewish people, but the Gemara says that if you are capable of changing your family and you do not do so, you're responsible for the family. If you're capable of changing your city, you don't do so, you're responsible for the city. If you're capable of changing the whole world and you do not do so, you're responsible for the whole world. Which means we don't look at a person as being a tzaddik, as righteous, if that person has not affected others. If that person is just by himself, isolated in a vacuum, but has not helped others, then they're responsible for the other people as well. So when we see a righteous person suffering, apparently who's never done anything bad to anyone else, for us it's not good enough. It's not good enough to say, I haven't hurt anyone. Your average person, you'll say, you're a good person. Average people will say, yeah, I haven't hurt anyone. Well, that's great. That doesn't make you a good person. Like, is it a good doctor if it says, you know, he's got his diploma from Harvard, and next to it it says, haven't killed anyone yet? That's not impressive, right? If he says on it, I've healed a lot of people, we probably wouldn't put up stats, let's say, but if he put up the stats and it would say a lot of people healed, that's more impressive. So there is an idea also of reward for a person. Sometimes an evil person may be rewarded in this world. Why? HaKadosh Baruch Hu may be rewarding someone in this world because he deserves reward. He's done something good. But ultimately, in the ultimate reward of Olam Haba, the world to come, this person will be out of it. Because a person is paid in the currency that they value. If you value cheeseburgers and a Hummer, right, then the payment for the good that you've done is cheeseburgers and a Hummer. But if a person values closeness to Hashem, if a person values elevation spiritually, then the reward for that person will be, he won't get the cheeseburger and the Hummer, right? But what he'll get is the, those who don't know what cheeseburgers and Hummers are, everyone know, right? Okay, good. Alright, so, he'll be rewarded in a different world in a higher spiritual level. There is also, I should point out, although this is not 100% agreed upon by all philosophers, but certainly all the Mekubalim do agree with this, and almost all contemporary, Gedolim would say, that we believe there's an idea of Gilgal. Gilgal is the idea that there's reincarnation, which means the soul is not here only for the 70, 80, 90 years of our life. The soul was here before and the soul will be here afterwards. And there are many things that happen to a person, which may be, as the Zohar says this in Mishpatim, but there's many things that happen to a person as a result of what we call the tikkun, meaning what does the soul need? What's the perfection that that soul needs? The person in this world is given that which the soul needs. A famous story, I don't know who, I think it's the Baal Shem Tov, who one morning decides, calls the Mohel, and he gets 8 Hasidim, and he says, come with me, 8 of his Talmidim, come with me, we're going to do a bris. They travel out of the town to a small house, it's horrific weather, it's freezing, there's ice on the ground, right, there's snow, etc. They come to a small house, and the guy comes to the door, the Baal Shem Tov says to him, Mazel Tov, and he says, oh, thank you. He says, we've come to do a bris for your son. And the guy, really, you know, he had a son 8 days earlier. They were scared to take him out. It was horrific weather. The carriage was broken. The horse was half dead. You know how it is, right? Standard, you know, shtetl stuff. Anyway, so they didn't know what to do. Here, the Baal Shem Tov turns up with a moyel and a minion. It's awesome, right? So they do the bris. The father calls the kid Yosef. So Yosef, after the bris, the mother takes him into a next room to nurse him. And there's a horrific scream. They run into the next room. Yosef has died. The little kid, Nifter. And, it's horrific. It's turned from a simcha to an avel. Terrible, terrible situation. So they sit there with the family for a while. They take care of what's necessary in terms of burial. And on the way back to wherever they were, Mezhebosh, right? So on the way back, one of the Hasidim asked the Baal Shem Tov, what's going, could you explain to me what just went on? We had this unbelievable, yet unbelievable hashkocha that you realize you need to do this bris. We do the bris and that's it. So he says, of course, today is the Yortzeit of Rav Yosef Karo. The Yortzeit of Rav Yosef Karo, author of the Shulchan Aruch, amongst other things, he says, did you not know that Rav Yosef Karo, that's why the father, Ruach HaKodesh, called the kid Yosef. He says, so I want to tell you something. He says, this child is the Gilgal. That's the soul of Rav Yosef Karo that came to this world. The soul of Yosef Karo, you know what? It needed one thing. When he was born, there was some type of cholera epidemic where he was born. The doctors, they would not allow him to have a bris milah. They felt it was dangerous. He didn't have a bris milah bismana. He didn't have a bris on time. The one thing the soul of Rav Yosef Karo needed, you know what it was? A bris on the 8th day. He had the bris on the 8th day. So we have to understand that very often there's a concept, this is according to the Mekubalim, that there can be something happening here in this world because of a tikkun, something, perfection, something the child or the person needs from a previous incarnation. And that we know that the Chazon Ish was a famous story. The Chazon Ish stood up, a lady came to the Chazon Ish for a brocha, and he stood up for her, together with, she came in with her child who had, I think it was Down syndrome, I do not remember for sure, but she came in with her child and they walk in together, he stands up. It was very unusual because the Chazon Ish was in his 80s at the time, I think it was, late 70s. He was the greatest Rav in Eretz Yisrael and he should stand up for, you know, it's very unusual. So the lady was a little stunned. She says, why did the Rav stand up? He says, because every soul comes to this world with kalim, with vessels, utensils, with which to do its job. He says, you should know your obligation is to expand your child's capacity and ability as much as possible. He says, but you also have to understand that his capacities And his kalim, his utensils are very limited. He says what that means is that there's very little that his soul has to accomplish in this world. Which means, he says, I'm in the presence of a neshama which is almost at the end of its journey. I'm in the presence of a neshama that has almost achieved tikkun, almost achieved perfection. He says, I'm standing up for that almost perfect neshama. So that's what he said, as the Chazon Ish said, right? And of course, that's based on this idea of Gilgul. So that is in terms of past, right? Now we come to the future. That is to say, we're going to attack whether, in other words, that's one way of looking at it. There's another way of looking at it. What is the justification of something in the future for what is happening now? So that is what we call, we're attacking the bad things or the good things happening to the good person or to the bad person. Clear? That's the second half of the equation. So here, it's a few points. First of all, there are certainly, we can't necessarily know, but there's no question, looking at this, the parasha we just read, that certainly from the perspective of Avraham Avinu, the whole situation of the Akedah was very difficult. Certainly for Yitzhak, very, very difficult for them. But what has been gained from the Akedah? Well, for us, what has been gained from the Akedah is incredible. The lessons that Jews have learned from the Akedah, the inspiration that we have derived from the Akedah, everything that the blessings and the covenants and the bris, etc., that has come to the Klal Yisrael as a result of the Akedah Yitzchak, right, that is something which, very, very difficult. Not everyone can see when they're in the situation what is going to come out of that. I know someone in Har Nof in Yerushalayim, and she had a great difficulty in having children. She had numerous stillbirths and a couple of miscarriages. She now, I think, has a number of four children, I believe. But the first, 8 years or so of her marriage, she went through terrible, terrible suffering. During that time, she enrolled herself in various courses in psychology to help herself get through the situation, right? And she found it helpful. What happened is eventually she got a degree in, I think it was psychology. And after a while, she started also counseling women who'd gone through reproductive issues, problems like that. Now, you can ask yourself, who could be a better counselor for a woman who has gone through this than this woman? Could there be anyone better? Right? A, if it was a male psychologist, he can't identify to the same degree, empathize to the same degree. He's never gone through pregnancy, etc. Right? Number two, even a woman would be very difficult if she's never gone through the same thing. But here is someone who's a woman. She's gone through it, right? And she's trained in this area. Unbelievable. But she once said, had anyone told me this while I was going through the suffering, look, unbelievable. This is really actually quite good because in the future you can do a lot of counseling. She said, I would have punched him in the face. Right, she would have been right, she would have been totally right. But in the end, looking back, what we call hindsight, right, looking back on things like that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe Rabbeinu, you cannot see the front, right, not my face, but Acharei. And many of the commentaries point out what it means that you can see from behind is very often we as humans can only see the results of divine providence. We can only see what looked like a tragedy. We can only see it in retrospect. Lemafreya, from like, as it says, Kesher Tfilin Hera Le'anav, we said today in Anim Zmirois, the knot of the Tfilin God showed to Moshe Rabbeinu. What it means is, where things tie together, you can only see it from behind, from the back. That's what you see. Kesher Tfilin, that's where you saw things tie together. I mean, there's many, many historical examples of this, but I'll give you one example. It's slightly controversial, but whatever, this is the example, is like this. Alfred Dreyfus, who was accused by the French government of spying for the Germans, and as a terrible trial, sentenced to Devil's Island for who knows how long, stripped of his rank, humiliated publicly. It was obviously anti-Semitism, right? And then, very soon after that, he had a terrible, right before that, the terrible situation, there was a bank which the Vatican had in France, which basically was mismanaged, and there was a whole bunch of problems with it. The bank was taken over as a hostile takeover by a banking family that saved the bank. A lot of people lost money. The family was the Rothschilds, Jewish, right? And right before then, the Panama Canal project, which France had financed, collapsed. Why? Because the workers came down with all types of tropical diseases. So instead of blaming the mosquitoes or the tsetse flies in Panama, right? So what they blamed, the people they blamed were the Jews, Jewish bankers who sold bonds to finance the Panama Canal project. So by the time Dreyfus came along, you can imagine there was a wave of anti-Semitism. First the Panama Canal, then then the Vatican Bank, and then a Jewish spy, right, in the government, right, in the army. You can imagine wave of anti-Semitism. So obviously that's all terrible, terrible. But you probably know that as a result of that, right, there was a reporter, right, for a Viennese newspaper by the name of Theodor Herzl, who was watching these events and saw people running through the streets of Paris yelling death to the Jews and was horrified by the event. And actually it sparked off his thoughts and the whole idea of the Zionist movement. He said, I say it's controversial, not everyone will agree this is a good thing. But for those of you who do, right, those of us who do, anyway, you can, but the idea of the establishment of a state of Israel in which there are now 6 million Jews living there and which their Torah has been blossoming, etc., with all its problems, yes, yes, I know the problems. But the fact of the matter is, that is a result of these events, which when you look back, you can say, Dreyfus, terrible, Neuer Va'oyom, the Vatican Bank, etc., etc. I know sympathy for the Vatican, right, but I'm saying the anti-Semitism, so we look at it, in retrospect, we can sometimes see the kesher tefillin, we can sometimes see the knot. So that's looking back at things. Also, we have to know that people develop noble characteristics very often through challenge, right, as I think it was Heinrich Heine, a great German poet, who once put it this way. He says, without tension, there is no creativity. Or to put it in the words of William James, the Harvard psychologist, William James put it, he says, a violin whose strings are not stretched will produce lousy music. So the human violin, when the strings are stretched, produces beautiful music. And Douglas Bader, you've probably heard of Douglas Bader, the famous English airman. Douglas Bader was very famous for, between the First and Second World War, he had a plane crash and he lost both legs. And he was a double amputee and they gave him artificial limbs, which at the time were not very well, developed. The technology was not there for it. But he managed to re-enlist in the Royal Air Force in the Second World War, which is incredible. And they had him train pilots. So Canadian, Australian and other Commonwealth pilots who volunteered for the Royal Air Force during the Second World War were trained by Douglas Bader. And I met a Canadian pilot who said, he's standing on the field, Douglas Bader comes out of the Jeep, right? And they thought it was some type of stupid joke. This is a guy, double amputee, but yet he trained them. He was inspiring to them, and he actually got into the plane. He was able to do maneuvers that no one else could do, partially because there was the blood pressure very often when the tight turns, he was able to stay conscious. But he was able to inspire people. He actually flew missions, and he is considered to be, by many, many of the historians of the Royal Air Force, considered to be one of those responsible for saving for the Battle of Britain, and for actually the victory over the Luftwaffe in their attempt to soften England before the invasion. He flew bombing missions over Germany, right, during the Second World War. He was shot down during a bombing mission. He survived, parachuted out and survived. He was put in a prisoner of war camp. He escaped twice. They took away his legs. There was massive protest. They gave him back. He escaped again, right. The guy was amazing, right. Now, and much of what he was able to do to inspire people, much of what he was able to do to save the world, us, right, the defeat of the Nazis, to save the world, was based on the fact that he had this double amputation. So we very often only see it in the end. In other words, something could happen now for a future benefit. There could be also an evil person, as the Rambam points out in Pirush Mishnayos, an evil person who could prosper for the benefit of future people, right? Yachin Rosha Yulvash Tzadik, I think is a pasuk, that a Rosha, the evil person, prepares something, and the righteous person wears it. The Rambam says he may have built a villa with a beautiful orchard and trees around it, etc., so that a righteous person could take shelter in a storm under a tree which the evil person planted. You know, there are people, I know of people who inherited money from a person, from people who are not great people, but what they do with the money is fantastic. So there is an idea of a future benefit of the present suffering, or a future, or something in the future which is happening, like the benefit of a righteous person from the prior success of the evil person. Again, I'm going very fast through this because we have very limited time. Each of these points obviously can be elaborated on and should be, but that's anyway a little bit of an intro. Those are two of the responses. One is attacking the idea of bad person, good person. The other is the attacking the idea of good thing, bad thing. I think also it's important to note that we have incomplete information. This is another approach, which is that more or less you could say that might be HaKadosh Baruch Hu's answer to Eov, but the idea that we should have the ability to absolutely understand everything that's going on when we don't always know all the details is incredible. There's a medrash, probably not from Chazal, but it's in one of these collections in Midrashim, which is probably not authentic, but it's a good story anyway. So it says the following, that Moshe Rabbeinu asks Hashem to explain Tzadik Baralo, the suffering of the righteous and the prosperity of the wicked. So Hashem says, okay, watch this scene. Hashem shows him a scene. In the scene that he sees the following. You have to listen carefully to this. This is what he sees in the scene. He sees a soldier, an elderly soldier, right, whatever, on a horse, a general, right. He's on his horse, and as he's at a watering hole, as he gets on the horse, his money bag drops off, and he rides away. Anyway, in the meantime, you see this teenager walks by, sees the money bag, says, no one's around, totally deserted, picks it up, he puts it in his pocket, he walks off. Right, in the meantime, an elderly vagabond, a guy, you know, total, a drunk, etc., alternative lifestyle, right, he lies down next to the, and relaxes next to the pond. So anyway, in the meantime, the soldier gets to a gas station, he pats his pocket, he sees, oh my gosh, wallet's gone. So he retraces his steps back to the pond, he sees this old drunk lying down in the pond, he says, I want my money. And the guy says, well, I don't know what you're talking about. He says, look, there's no one else here, you've got my money. The guy says, no, I don't. He resists. Anyway, the soldier in the fight kills him, searches this drunk, finds no money, says, okay, gets back on his horse, drives off. So Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, you see, perfect justice. Right? No? Anyone? No. Okay. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, I don't understand it. Hashem says, let me show you another story. He shows him this other story. There's a little kid walking with his father, and they're walking with his father in the forest, and a thief jumps out, right, and attacks them. The kid's screaming, the thief like beats the father into unconsciousness, the father's lying there on the ground, right, the kid's crying his head off, the thief searches the father, finds a bag of money. Anyway, in the meantime, there's this young soldier who was on a patrol, and he sees what's happening, he doesn't get involved, he's a New Yorker, right, and he sees what's happening, and then he jumps out, right, after the attack, he jumps out, he says, he pulls out his sword, he says to the thief, now give me the money. So the thief gives him the money, and the thief runs away, right, the soldier runs away with the money, and the kid's lying there crying with his father on the ground. So Hashem says, you see, perfect justice. He says, I don't see it. He says, okay, let me explain. The second story happened first. The little kid in the second story who lost the father's money, right, he is the teenager who found the money in the first story. You following? He says the young soldier who didn't intervene and he took the money in the second story, he is the general who lost the money in the first story. And the thief who attacked the father and the kid but didn't get the money and was not punished for this in the second story, he is the old drunk who gets killed by the soldier in the first story. Do not ask me to repeat this, right? But that's basically, right, very often we are in situations where this is what we see. Okay, now, one more idea about suffering. So that's incomplete information and seeing things out of sequence, etc. One more idea about suffering, which is very, very important, is the idea of free will. Which is, we understand, and it's axiomatic in Judaism, that Olam Chesed Yibaneh, Hashem created the world as an expression of his total goodness. As the Ramchal puts it, Derech Hatov Lahitiv, it's the way of the good to give. It's the way of the good to give. That is an axiom. Okay, so a person could argue with that, but that's where we start. That Hashem created the world to give, and it is the way of the good to give. Now, the ultimate giving, the ultimate good, is of course Hashem himself. God himself is the ultimate good. Which means the ultimate good available to the creature is what? A relationship with Hashem. Because he can't be Hashem, right? He's a creature, he's not the creator. But she can have a relationship with the creator. But in order to have a relationship with the creator, requires what? It requires compatibility. Relationship requires closeness, compatibility. Closeness is not measured in centimeters, it is measured in compatibility, in similarity. So to be similar to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right, is really the goal here. But in order to be similar to Hashem, right, Hashem's goodness comes from where? Does it come from outside or inside? Well, that's a silly question, isn't it? Because there is nothing outside of Hashem. So where does Hashem's goodness come from? Totally from within. He's totally from within, correct? For the person to be like Hashem, for us to be godlike, doimer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who's similar to Hashem, where does our goodness have to come from? has to come from within, correct? Okay, so the only way for the goodness to come from within, if I'm created good, then the goodness is not coming from within, it's coming from where? From outside. It is planted in me. If I'm created perfect, right, then I'm not really perfect. Like angels are not really good in that sense. I mean, they're not tzaddikim. We don't describe them as tzaddikim because they haven't worked on it. They're stationary bees. The good has to come from within. How can the good come from within? The good can only come from within if I struggle for it. That means if I work against the opposition. That means there has to be a world in which there is the ability to do good or to do, God forbid, the opposite. So a world in which there's an ability to do good or the opposite is a world in which there is free will. But that world requires certain conditions. For example, if every time I do make an evil decision, I fail miserably and I don't succeed in life, then, and every time I make a good decision, I'm successful in life, then obviously I will be doing good and not bad. But there would not be the ideal, would it? Because there, what would I be? It would be called conditioning. You'd be like a rat in a Skinner maze. You know, psychology labs, they're supposed to call them rats, it's not politically correct, non-human animal research participants, right? So the non-human animal research participant in the Skinner maze presses one lever, it gets bipolar electroconvulsive therapy, unpleasant, I've been told, right? And if it presses another lever, it gets food pellets, big reward, anyway. But whatever, right? The rat is going to, whatever, please forgive me, the rats, whatever. But it will be conditioned. God does not want us to be a bunch of rats in his lab. He wants us to be beings who make decisions based on our bechira, our free will. So he creates a world in which there is a certain ability of evil to prosper. There is an ability of evil to be successful. You could cheat in business and be successful. You could be honest and be a failure. You might be very, very nice in the traffic. You let people merge and etc. And you'll never, ever get through the Lincoln Tunnel. You'll get there Monday morning, Friday afternoon, maybe you'll get out. Right? That's it. Right? You've got to be a little bit aggressive and nasty to survive in New York. Right? But doesn't work. The good guy is not going to necessarily get there first. Right? So the way the world works is there is a certain amount of ability given to evil that evil can indeed prosper, evil can indeed succeed. And if not for that, life would really be meaningless. And a meaningful life is a life in which we actually work on our goodness and combat evil, but that's a life in which we have to accept the fact that evil can sometimes prosper, and that evil can sometimes not only prosper, but can actually win over good. In the end, it won't. We have that as a central belief, that in the end, it won't. But in the meantime, it sometimes does. So that is a little bit of an intro to that first topic. I think I have... when did I start? 9:15? I don't... Huh? Till 9:10. Okay. Great. We're doing all right, I think. Okay, so now we turn to men and women. Again, please, this is not a complete take on these topics. I mean, you can understand there's a tremendous amount to be said on it, but okay. I think if a few points to be made in terms of men and women in Judaism, which I think are important points to make, especially for someone who comes from Western culture, is that, number one, do not equate, and this might be obvious to you, so I'm sorry, but do not equate equality and sameness. Sameness is not the same as equality. Meaning, right, we understand, we believe, and it's not a matter of belief, it's an empirical fact. Men and women are different. You could ask someone, no, they're not. People will say, no, it's just cultural conditioning. Girls play with Barbies, and boys play with little guns and stuff like that. That's why they're different. But we know that that is not so. You could ask someone, look, does the way someone look, the way someone looks, their physical makeup, does it make a difference? In other words, you can have someone like, let's say, a 300-pound quarterback, for American football, right? A 300-pound quarterback, right? Huge guy, muscles in his eyelids, etc. Like, this guy, unbelievable. Would his psychology be different than Woody Allen? Okay? 90-pound weakling, right? Pathetic, wimp, right? Obviously, their psychology is going to be totally different, right? Because one guy walks through the world, right, without nothing, right? He can walk over your Hummer. I mean, you know, he could be hit by a beetle and have to have it removed in surgery. You know what I mean? That's what he's like, right? So basically, right, such a person is going to have different psychology than someone else. That's clear, right? Someone who's incredibly beautiful, right, amazingly handsome, right, is going to have a different psychology than someone who is not attractive. It's just, right, I think it's pretty clear. So it's obviously someone who has the ability, right, someone who a man or a woman, therefore by the very A, clearly going to have different perspectives on the world, different perspectives on life, etc., just because of their very, very nature of their bodies, and also, obviously, if you're able to carry a child, have pregnancy, give childbirth, etc., nurse, I mean, that's going to be massively, have differences in the psychology versus the male. So, yes, there is definitely a difference. We don't believe that we have to say everyone's the same, right? Right? In other words, equality should not be confused with sameness. And we believe that we should celebrate the differences between the male and the female. Vive la différence, right? The differences are something which we should actually... It's okay. We should actually celebrate and we should enhance. That is to say that a woman should be an excellent woman. A man should be an excellent man, right? The idea of a man being a great woman, vice versa, although it is, you know, pretty common in California, but for the rest of us is not something which we are going to be celebrating. So the way we understand it is the Torah, right, looks into the essence of what a human is about, the essence of what the male is about, the essence of what the female is about, and gives each one the ability to develop themselves in their own specific fields, in their own specific areas. That's number one. Number two, publicity in Jewish tradition, very different from Western tradition. In the Western world, if you could call it tradition, but in the Western world, what makes you important? If you're famous and you have power, right? Fame and power. If you're not famous, you hear car advertisements. They're always talking about this will turn heads. This car will turn heads. Your neighbours will be right? They'll be quelling. Probably the advertisement doesn't say quell, but whatever the equivalent is, right? Your neighbours. It's always about other person. In Jewish tradition, we look at it not that way. We would say that fame is not necessarily a measure of someone's success. Fame is not a measure of success, neither is power for that matter. So if you're judging Judaism, I would tell someone, from a Western perspective, you are like an anthropologist judging some tribe. You know, in Africa, right, they've got this guy who you walk into the tribe and there's this guy who's on a chair and he's being fed fine foods and people are waving, right, feathers in front of him, ostrich feathers, you know, in order to cool him down and everything. You say, oh my gosh, this guy must be the king. He might not be the king. He might be the guy they're going to sacrifice to the volcano god on Tuesday. You know, they're fattening him up. Right, so if you're an anthropologist, you've got to be aware of you can only judge a culture from the standards within the culture. Right? You cannot judge it from the standards of another culture. Right? You have to look at it from what's within, the thing as it is in itself, as opposed to the thing as it is in the eyes of someone from another culture. I hope those two points are very clear. Sameness and equality, not the same thing. You could be different and celebrate differences and still be equal, number one. Number two, right, publicity and fame and power are not great values in Judaism. Great values in Judaism is that a person is a good person, is a righteous person, is fulfilling their role and their purpose in the world. They could be unknown, they could be totally without fame, they could have zero power whatsoever, and in Judaism they are valued and is an important thing. So now I would also point out that the differences actually, or at least start back, and again we don't have time to talk about this at length, but if you look at the Netziv, Hamek Dovar, beginning of this week's parasha, Chayes, last week's parasha, strictly speaking, right, Chayes Sarah, fascinating sieve. He talks about the idea of Avraham and Sarah, each one having a different way of in which Hashem communicated with them. One is called Nevuah, that was Avraham, and the other is called Ruach HaKodesh, that was Sarah. What is the difference between Nevuah and Ruach HaKodesh? Nevuah is from the Hebrew word niv, as in niv sfasayin, the expression of the lips. It's the speaking, it's Hashem speaking to someone. It's a communication which is from outside in. Okay? What is Ruach HaKodesh? He says Ruach HaKodesh is, Hashem doesn't explicitly speak to you, but you know what Hashem wants by looking into yourself. Now he says the difference here is, many, many differences. You see with Avraham and Sarah, the classic case was, Sarah knew that Yishmael had to be thrown out. Vayera hadava ma'od ba'enei Avraham. Avraham was very upset about it, right? And what Hashem said is, kol ha'shatoyma lecha Sarah, shma b'kola, everything Sarah says to you, listen to her voice, my wife's favorite posuk, right? Everything Sarah says, listen to her voice. Why does it say shma b'kola? Why doesn't it say shma eleha? Listen to her. Listen to my voice. I went to a speech therapist. She said, I'd like to hear your voice. That's because she wants to hear my voice. Right, but if someone says, listen to me, they're not saying, listen to my voice, what do you think? They're saying, listen to me. What is Shema B'Kola? The answer is Kol Ruach HaKodesh, the voice of Ruach HaKodesh that was speaking, so to speak. Now, she knew the MS from within her. We see the next generation, it was the same thing. Next generation, it was Rivka who knew that the brocha should not go to Esav, it should go to Yaakov. And she says to Yaakov, V'ata b'ni, next week's parsha, this week's parsha, whatever, right, V'ata b'ni, I feel like I'm the reference to rejects, right, but she says, Shma b'ni, V'ata b'ni, Shma b'koli, La'asher ani mitzava oisach, now my son, listen to my voice. It doesn't say Shema Eli, listen to me, listen to my voice. Again, it's Ruach HaKodesh. How does Yitzchak find out that Yaakov should get the bracha and not Esav? External circumstances speak to him. Next generation, Yaakov, right, and he gets a dream. Hashem speaks to him in the dream. He says, you've got to leave the house of Lavan. He tells his wife, he goes to Rachel and Leah, and he says, listen, it's going to be rough. We have to leave your father's house. What's their reaction? Well, duh. Right, no, it's not exactly in the text. Right, but what they say is, ha'od lanu chelek v'nachala? Do we have any further inheritance with our father? Halakha nachrios neshamala. He looks at us like strangers. For them it was obvious. In other words, we find it's the communication is what we would call from inside out as opposed to outside in. Is this clear? Now, the Netziv says, what do you need for the communication which comes from inside out? He says, what you need is hisboidus. You need meditation. You need calm, tranquility, and a minimalization of exposure to the masses. Avram Avinu was out there with the masses because his job was nevuah, so therefore he didn't have the ability of the hisboidus because of his activities, so therefore he didn't have that. Sarah, who is emphasized in the last week's parsha, 2 weeks, whatever, she's hine ba'ohel, she's in the tent. One of the ideas was in the tent she had the tranquility, the ability of the hisboidus looking into the inner self. So if we look at that, that's a huge, amazing difference. And we look at that as a prototype of the male and female. That's Ad Kan, until here, is Divrei HaNetziv. I heard from my Rebbe, Rav Moshe Shapiro, that this idea, the Netziv says, serves as a prototype for the male and female models in Judaism for the rest of eternity. Because if you look through, for example, just give you a couple of examples of that. Men are generally obligated in the public mitzvahs. Right? Public things. Right, that require crowds, etc., etc., both deraisa, drabonon, but generally it's the public stuff. Why? Because for the man, where it's the communication from Hashem is from the outside in, these things are not necessarily a distraction to the main purpose. A woman is exempt from these because these could be a distraction from the tranquility and the inner reflection that is required to fulfill her role, which is that Ruach HaKodesh intuition aspect of knowing what's inside the soul. So that would be one example. Another example would be that women are not obligated in Talmud Torah. Obviously they have to learn, as the Shulchan Aruch says, everything they're obligated in, which is a fair amount, right? But nevertheless, the intrinsic obligation of Torah study just for the sake of Torah study, not an obligation. Same idea. The male has the external communication from outside in. For the woman, very often it's from inside out, right? If she has the appropriate hisboidus tranquility and the appropriate mitzvahs, it's the experiential. Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, in different terminology, he says that the role of education involves two things. It involves the content of Har Sinai and the experience of Har Sinai. He says the father gives the content of Har Sinai, the informational content, and the mother conveys the experience of Har Sinai. The experience is the internal, the informational content is more external. It's outside in versus inside out. We find also mitzvahs asei shazman groma, the mitzvahs which men are obligated in, which are the positive time-bound commandments. Again, there's only, I think, 7 examples Rav Meiselman mentions in his book, but whatever, 6, I think, but whatever, but nevertheless, those examples, he says, so based on the Maharal, is the idea that the mitzvah asis mangram is because even men need to have a time when they are told, okay, now chill out. Stop with the aggression, stop with the get up and go, just have some tranquility, some hisboidus, some meditation, etc., because men also need that. So we are imposed upon men certain times we have to stop and can't, okay? Yeah. Right. So do women maybe don't need that, and therefore they're not obligated in those things. So we have a few differences, but if we look at it, the way we look at it is there's different roles, different aspects of what the male and female are obligated in, and they actually go back to the different nature of the male and female, what we might call the supermen and wonder women of Judaism, which is Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Vilea, who serve as prototypes. Now the truth of the matter is, we should also point out these are prototypes. That means, a prototype means that there could be exceptions. There could be a man who excels in Ruach HaKodesh, and there were women who excelled in Nevuah. There were women who were great scholars, right? And there are men who are not, right? There could be, and a woman can do Mrs. Asher Shaz Mangroma in general, right? And according to Ashkenazim, can even make a bracha on it, right? And there's no chiyuv, for example, if a woman's going to be making the parnosa and they agree upon it, and the man can stay home and take care of the kids. No, it's not like an isser in halacha. I know this is going to get stoned for this, but there's no prohibition in halacha for such a thing to happen. But we talk about the prototype means what's the ideal, and what's the prototype, the ideal? Of course, there could be always exceptions to the ideal. But that's a basic way of looking at it, that we see the mitzvahs and the status, and obviously the public role is not taken by the women, but I think it's very clear to me that, for example, when you look at the works of the Rambam, you're not looking at only the Rambam's works, you're looking at the work of the Rambam's mother and the Rambam's wife as well. Right? It's just the public expression of that was the Rambam. I mean, do you think it's conceivable that someone like the Rambam could come out of someone who's barefoot in the kitchen, barefoot and pregnant, I think is the expression? Right? I mean, it's highly unlikely. There has to be an environment in which can develop some people of such great stature. So Jewish women have been that environment, right, for thousands of years, and have also excelled in many, many other areas. And again, the idea of the way the mitzvahs look at it is not because one is not because they're the same, they're other rather. On the contrary, they are different, and we celebrate that difference. And not because they, and because they are different, spiritually different, so therefore we have different aspects of ways of enhancing in the mitzvahs what each one is created for. So that's a little bit of an introduction to the way I would deal with the male and female issue. Okay. I don't think I'm going to have time to do accuracy of the oral tradition. Shall I open up to questions, or you prefer that I do the accuracy of the oral tradition? In 8 minutes. I could try. I mean, I can speak fast. I mean, whatever. Right? Whatever I'm taking is fine. Okay, so, first of all, a few points about the oral tradition. A, the reason we need it. Because if you look in the Torah itself, in that you take out a scroll of the Torah, you'll find no vowels, no punctuation, and the word's not explained. Which means just the Torah of itself, in and of itself, is an incomprehensible book. As a standalone text, you cannot fulfill the precepts of the Torah Shebichsav. There's not one precept you can fulfill, even when it says something like, don't murder, lo tirtzach. What do you have to do to define murder? Don't you have to define about whom it's referring to? Humans? Primates? Right? What is it referring to? Etc. And even when you do that, you have to define what is murder. Okay, so you have to say killing of an innocent person who's not threatening me. You have to go into self-defense. You have to go into definition of life and death. When does life start? Is it 40 days? Is it as soon as there is fertilization of the egg? Is it as soon as the head comes out of it? Right, I mean, when does life start? When does life end? Very, very controversial. Lots of different definitions. In the secular world, there's 5 different definitions of death which are in use today. Or 4, I think it is. Birmingham criteria, the Harvard criteria, brain death, the cardiopulmonary, I mean, there's many different criteria, right? This is a legal issue. You want to define something, and you want to read the Torah. You can't even read it. Is it chalav or chaleb? Is it milk or is it fat? Is it bamayim, in the water, that you have to immerse to be tahor, or is it butmayim, in water? Right? What is it? Right? And when the Torah says, yei ra'eh, does that, when yud reish aleph hey, does it mean see? Does it mean yira, fear? Does it mean yira, will be seen? Does it mean yara, he will show? Right? Punctuation. What about punctuation? You don't have punctuation? Right? Then sentences get run. I mean, it's very, very difficult to know. So all of these components, the definitions of words, to say, do something today. Torah says, do it today. When does day start? In secular law, right now, we're on Saturday. Right? And in secular law, Sunday will start midnight tonight. As far as halacha goes, it's now Yom Rishon. It's Yom Rishon. So you have to define all these things. The Torah doesn't give you definitions. The Torah says, on the 10th day of the 7th month, by the way, the calendar, there's only 2 sentences in the entire Torah about the calendar. 2 sentences. Guard, Shmoris Chodesh Aviv, guard the month of spring, that's one. And what's the other one? HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodesh, and this month will be the first month, that's it. From this, we're supposed to develop a calendar. Folks, right? Either the author was cruel, sadistic. Here's a nuclear power plant, but no instructions. mess around with it, see what happens. What's going on? So obviously we would say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us additional information. The additional information is what we call the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral tradition. And indeed, the way Rav Hirsch puts it, he says, the Torah Shebichsav are the written notes of a lecture. The lecture was a 40-year lecture. 40 years. What were the Jews doing in the desert? All the events, almost all the events happened in the first and last year. Middle 38 years, what are they doing? Beautiful sand dunes. I mean, 38 years. The laundry's taken care of, food's taken care of. It's unbelievable, right? So they're learning the Torah. They're learning Torah. So if you have heard a lecture and you know the shorthand, and I show you the notes, it makes sense to you. But if you didn't hear the lecture and you don't know the shorthand, it makes no sense. So here we are, all part of people who know the shorthand. So if I tell you something like, Ukshartam lois al yodecha, v'hayilu tatafois benecha, bind them as a sign upon your arms, put a frontlet between your eyes, tomorrow morning, what will you do? You go to a piercing parlor, like a frontlet, please. Right? What does that mean? Right? The answer is, it's tefillin. But we heard the lecture, we know the code. When I tell you, when the Torah says, on the 10th day of the 7th month, afflict your soul, the inisem esnafsho seichem, what does it mean? Roll around on thumbtacks, read Russian novels, do both simultaneously. What does it mean? The answer is we have an oral tradition. Don't try that at home, please. Right? The oral tradition teaches us exactly what it means. So that's number one, is the Torah as a standalone book doesn't make sense, cannot be conveyed, cannot be lived. It's either you believe that the author is just trying to torture us, or there is additional information, as alluded to in the Torah in a couple of places, as I have commanded you, right? There's nowhere in the Torah that it says how to shecht an animal, and yet the Torah tells us, right, as I have commanded you in Dvarim 12, 21, right, where the Torah is alluding to an existence of another body of information other than that which is written. Now you could ask, is there any advantage to an oral tradition? A few advantages. Number one, the study ethic. If something's all written down, in order to preserve it, you know what you need? A feather duster and a humidity controlled room. If something's not written down, what do you need in order to preserve it? To learn. Right, the mitzvah of learning Torah has been such an unbelievable. The Jewish people learn Torah in their spare time. Here it is, Motzei Shabbos, right, Saturday night, right. Most Americans are doing this, right. What are Jews doing? We are learning Torah. Who learns in their spare time? People get up at 6:05 in the morning to do Daf Yomi every single day for years and years. There's a train from Long Island Railroad train to Manhattan. Every day for like 10 years they've had a Daf Yomi Shir on the carriage. Unbelievable. Jews in their spare time learn. Right? Who learns in their spare time? Who learns law in their spare time? Lawyers. That's usually in order to get around it. Right? But we learn Torah in our spare time. It's unbelievable. The study ethic is a result of the oral tradition. That's number one. Number two, also what it means is it's harder to steal. What has happened to the Torah Shebichsav, the written law? People have plagiarized it. People have misquoted it. People have distorted it. People have used it to justify their own distortions of Judaism and monotheism. There are skid marks all over the Torah. Hashkocha Protis, that the Christian scriptures were written about 100 years before the Mishnah was written. You know why that's great, tremendous Hashkocha? Because had it been written after the Mishnah, guess what they would have been using, misusing in the Christian scriptures? They would have been misusing Mishnah. Right? It's bad enough. So the fact that the Torah was Baal Peh for so many years meant that it was an intimate form of communication between God and the Jewish people that was private. You know how it is, right? You write things down, you've got an email, there's a record of it. Don't keep emails, right? So when you have it all up there, that's it. It's between Hashem and the Jewish people. It's an intimate, tremendous connection. To put it into more poetic, beautiful terms, this is how the Beis Halevi puts it, the Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the first, right? He puts it beautifully. He says, if the Torah would all be written down, the Jewish people would be like the Aron Kodesh, would be the container of the Torah. Holy? Yes. Wonderful, fantastic. He says, now the Torah is primarily Baal Peh, oral. He says the Jewish people are the klaf, the parchment upon which the Torah is written. That's a much higher level of Kedusha. He says we are not the actions of the Jewish people, the minhagim of the Jewish people, the history of the Jewish people, the events of the Jewish people, that becomes Torah. So we are the Torah. That's Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, there's many other reasons. It's anti-superficiality device. It creates the study ethic. It's harder to steal. It's portable. It's compact. There's a feedback mechanism. When I speak to you as opposed to writing it down, I know if you've understood. I look at your face. I can see you standing there like, like that, I know it probably didn't understand, right? But, you know, you can tell there's a feedback mechanism. The Rambam says that, not with the facial expression. So that is an idea. How do we know it was transmitted accurately? The security mechanisms. First of all, we didn't have one chain. How many chains and transmissions do we have? Every mother and daughter, every grandmother and granddaughter, every father and son, every grandparent and grandparent was another chain. We had thousands of parallel chains of transmission. If I want to get a message to you, right, I'll phone your cell phone, leave a message. I'll phone your house phone, leave a message. I'll phone your business and leave a message. I'll send you a fax. I'll send you an email. I'll FedEx something. I'll overnight it. I'll send you a singing telegram, etc. Right? At the end of it, you'll hate me, but you'll get the message. Right? The more, so even if your fax machine's out of paper, even if the singing telegram guy gets mugged, even if the email box is corrupt, whatever it is, full, right, etc. But the message will get through. The Jewish people had thousands of chains. There are still Jewish people today who are keeping the Torah based on Torah Shabbat Peh. How do I know that? Because in my own family, I know people like that. I know people who are keeping Shabbos. They didn't study Shemirah Shabbos Kehilchasa. I guarantee they didn't. Right? And I know that there are people I know who, when they were little girls, there was no school for girls. But they know how to keep Shabbos. They know Kashrus. They know Torah Shabbat Peh. Where do they know it? Where do they know it? The answer is they heard it from their mother. Where does she know it from? Right? They didn't have art scroll. Can you conceive of a world without art scroll? They didn't have it, right? They didn't have art scroll. They didn't have it, so what did they have, right? They got it from Torah Shabbat Peh. There are people today, right, who are keeping the Torah based on an oral transmission going back approximately 120 mothers and daughters, right, back to Har Sinai. It's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. So the Torah Shabbat Peh, that's one security mechanism. In addition, it's a logical system, meaning you can see discrepancies. That's much of what Chazal are about, looking for discrepancies, etc. The message is ingrained in you from the time you're a little kid in a normal Jewish home. When do you start learning about Shabbos? When the kid comes home from hospital after birth, right? And he's lying there and he sees these things, candles, and then the people are saying Shabbos, and he hears the word Shabbos, and he hears songs, and then someone puts a finger in his mouth with some sweet wine, and he's saying the Shabbos thing is cool, right, etc. And the whole word, he's learning about Shabbos. By the time he's 3 or 4, he hasn't learnt it from a text, but he knows a heck of a lot about Shabbos. It's an amazing thing. So it's ingrained in you from the time you're a little kid. A person could reject it, Chalila, but to forget that, very, very difficult. There are written references. We have Torah, Nevi'im, Ksuvim, etc. Even before it was written down, the Mishnah, there was an inertia of an entire society. And in the days before Blackberries, Palm Pilots, etc., people used to use something called memory. They used to work on it. There were review mnemonic devices. In the ancient world, most information stuff was transmitted orally because it was very difficult to write it down. What would you have? Walk around with a clay tablet and a stylus? What are you going to do? Right? And it's all in Roman numerals too, for heaven's sakes. So very, very rough. People would remember things. And the Chazal used the memory techniques, review mnemonic devices, rhymes, tunes, tosis, etc. in the end of Megillah. I mean, they used to use Shittim HaKabetzis and Bava Kama, rhyming, etc. They used to use things like that to remember stuff. Right? People used to use their memories more. So the oral law was part of that whole technique. And aside from which, I want to tell you one important thing. The oral law is supposed to teach you not just information and facts, but how to live. You want to learn how to live, you can't learn that from a book necessarily. My book obviously can, but I mean other books, right? You have to learn it from a human being. I mean, I often ask people this question. Anyone here know how to swim? Put up your hands. Know how to swim? Excellent, a lot of people. Anyone who learned how to swim from a book, please put up your hand. Yeah, I've asked this question of thousands of people all over the world. No one ever put up their hand who learned how to swim from a book. And the reason is very simple, because tragically, people who learn how to swim from a book are not with us to put their hand up. To learn how to live a life of a Jew requires contact with another Jew, requires contact with a person. It's not enough to have a book. It's not enough to have a CD. It's not enough to have an internet program. You've got to have a human being, right? And the idea of the Torah Shabbat Peh is the contact with another human being. Even if it was written down, even once it was written down, you still needed contact with the human beings. And that's as far as we can go because the time is out. I'm going to get shot with a tranquilizer dart if I go on. So thank you very much, and we'll see you.